on that I can see, apart from the exit signs. It is in their blue glow that I see Tobias emerge from the interrogation room up ahead. Since our date, I have spoken to him only in covert messages. I have to resist the urge to throw myself at him and brush my fingers over the curl of his lip and the crease in his cheek when he smiles and the hard line of his eyebrow and jaw. But it's 2 minutes to midnight. We don't have any time. He wraps his arms around me and holds me tight for a few seconds. His breaths tickle my ear, and I close my eyes, letting myself finally relax. He smells like wind and sweat and soap, like Tobias and like safety.
"Should we go in?" he says. "Whoever they are, they're probably prompt."
"Yes." My legs are trembling from overexertion. I can't imagine going down the stairs and running back to Erudite headquarters later.
"Did you find out about Caleb?"
He winces.
"Maybe we should talk about that later."
That's all the answer I need.
"They're going to execute him, aren't they?"
I say softly. He nods and takes my hand. I don't know how to feel. I try not to feel anything. Together, we walk into the room where Tobias and I were once interrogated under the influence of truth serum. The place where you made your confession. A circle of lit candles is arranged on the floor over one of the candor scales set into the tile. There is a mix of familiar and unfamiliar faces in the room. Susan and Robert stand together, talking. Peter is alone on the side of the room, his arms crossed. Uriah and Zeke are with Tori and a few other Dauntless. Christina is with her mother and sister. And in a corner are two nervous-looking erudite. New outfits can't erase the divisions between us. They are ingrained. Christina beckons to me. "This is my mom, Stephanie," she says, indicating a woman with gray streaks in her dark curly hair. "And my sister, Rose. Mom, Rose, this is my friend Triss, and my initiation instructor, Four."
"Obviously," Stephanie says. "We saw their interrogation several weeks ago, Christina."
"I know that. I was just being polite."
"Politeness is deception in..."
Yeah, I know."
Christina rolls her eyes. Her mother and sister, I notice, look at each other, with something like wariness or anger, or both. Then her sister turns to me and says,
"So, you killed Christina's boyfriend."
Her words create a cold feeling inside me, like a streak of ice divides one side of my body from the other. I want to answer, to defend myself, but I can't find the words.
"Rose," Christina says, scowling at her.
At my side, Tobias straightens, his muscles tensing, ready for a fight, as always.
"I just thought we would air everything out," Rose says. "It wastes less time."
"And you wonder why I left our faction," Christina says. "Being honest doesn't mean you say whatever you want whenever you want. It means that what you choose to say is true."
"A lie of omission is still a lie."
"You want the truth? I'm uncomfortable and don't want to be here right now. I'll see you guys later."
She takes my arm and walks Tobias and me away from her family, shaking her head the whole time.
"Sorry about that. They're not really the forgiving type."
"It's fine," I say, though it's not. I thought that when I received Christina's forgiveness, the hard part of Will's death would be over. But when you kill someone you love, the hard part is never over. It just gets easier to distract yourself from what you've done. My watch reads 12 o'clock. A door across the room opens, and in walk two lean silhouettes. The first is Johanna Reyes, former spokesperson of Amity, identifiable by the scar that crosses her face and the hint of yellow peeking out from under her black jacket. The second is another woman, but I can't see her face, just that she is wearing blue. I feel a spike of terror.
She looks almost like...
Janine. No, I saw her die. Janine is dead.
The woman comes closer. She is statuesque and blonde, like Janine. A pair of glasses dangles from her front pocket, and her hair is in a braid. An erudite from head to foot. But not Janine Matthews.
Kara.
Kara and Johanna are the leaders of the Allegiant?
Hello,
Kara says, and all conversation stops. She smiles, but on her the expression looks compulsory, like she's just adhering to a social convention.
We aren't supposed to be here, so I'm going to keep this meeting short. Some of you, Zeke, Tori, have been helping us for the past few days.
I stare at Zeke. Zeke has been helping Kara? I guess I forgot that he was once a Dauntless spy. Which is probably when he proved his loyalty to Kara. He had some kind of friendship with her before she left Erudite headquarters not long ago.
He looks at me, wiggles his eyebrows, and grins. Johanna continues.
Some of you are here because we want to ask for your help. All of you are here because you don't trust Evelyn Johnson to determine the fate of this city.
Kara touches her palms together in front of her.
We believe in following the guidance of the city's founders, which has been expressed in two ways, the formation of the factions and the divergent mission expressed by Edith Pryor, to send people outside the fence to help whoever is out there once we have a large divergent population. We believe that even if we have not reached that divergent population size, the situation in our city has become dire enough to send people outside the fence anyway. In accordance with the intentions of our city's founders, we have two goals: to overthrow Evelyn and the factionless so that we can reestablish the factions, and to send some of our number outside the city to see what's out there. Johanna will be heading up the former effort, and I will be heading up the latter, which is what we will mostly be focusing on tonight. She presses a loose strand of hair back into her braid. Not many of us will be able to go, because a crowd that large would draw too much attention. Evelyn won't let us leave without a fight, so I thought it would be best to recruit people who I know to be experienced with surviving danger.
I glance at Tobias. We certainly are experienced with danger.
Christina, Triss, Tobias, Tori, Zeke, and Peter are my selections, Kara says. You have all proven your skills to me in one way or another, and it's for that reason that I'd like to ask you to come with me outside the city. You are under no obligation to agree, of course.
Peter? I demand, without thinking. I can't imagine what Peter could have done to prove his skills to Kara.
He kept the erudite from killing you, Kara says mildly. Who do you think provided him with the technology to fake your death?
I raise my eyebrows. I'd never thought about it before. Too much happened after my failed execution for me to dwell on the details of my rescue. But of course, Kara was the only well-known defector from Erudite at that time. The only person Peter would have known to ask for help. Who else could have helped him? Who else would have known how?
I don't raise another objection. I don't want to leave this city with Peter. But I'm too desperate to leave to make a fuss about it.
That's a lot of Dauntless, a girl at the side of the room says, looking skeptical. She has thick eyebrows that don't stop growing in the middle, and pale skin. When she turns her head, I see black ink right behind her ear. A Dauntless transfer to Erudite, no doubt.
True, Kara says. But what we need right now are people with the skills to get out of the city unscathed, and I think Dauntless training makes them highly qualified for that task.
I'm sorry, but I don't think I can go, Zeke says. I couldn't leave Shauna here. Not after her sister just... well, you know.
I'll go, Uriah says, his hand popping up.
I'm Dauntless. I'm a good shot, and I provide much-needed eye candy.
I laugh. Kara does not seem to be amused, but she nods.
Thank you.
Kara, you'll need to get out of the city fast, the dauntless-turned erudite girl says. Which means you should get someone to operate the trains.
Good point, Kara says. Does anyone here know how to drive a train?
Oh, I do, the girl says. Was that not implied?
The pieces of the plan come together. Johanna suggests we take Amity trucks from the end of the railroad tracks out of the city, and she volunteers to supply them to us. Robert offers to help her. Stephanie and Rose volunteer to monitor Evelyn's movements in the hours before the escape, and to report any unusual behavior to the Amity compound by two-way radio. The Dauntless who came with Tori offer to find weapons for us. The erudite girl prods at any weaknesses she sees, and so does Kara. And soon, they are all shored up, like we have just built a secure structure. There is only one question left. Kara asks it. When should we go? And I volunteer an answer. Tomorrow night.
Chapter 9. Tobias. The night air slips into my lungs, and I feel like it is one of my last breaths. Tomorrow I will leave this place and seek another. Uriah, Zeke, and Christina start toward the erudite headquarters, and I hold Triss's hand to keep her back. Wait, I say. Let's go somewhere. Go somewhere? But just for a little while. I tug her toward the corner of the building. At night, I can almost see what the water looked like when it filled the empty canal, dark and patterned with moonlit ripples. You're with me, remember? They're not going to arrest you. A twitch at the corner of her mouth, almost a smile. Around the corner, she leans against the wall, and I stand in front of her, the river at my back. She's wearing something dark around her eyes to make their color stand out, bright and striking. I don't know what to do. She presses her hands to her face, curling her fingers into her hair. About Caleb, I mean. You don't? She moves one hand aside to look at me. Triss. I set my hands on the wall on either side of her face and lean into them. You don't want him to die. I know you don't. The thing is, she closes her eyes, I'm so angry. I try not to think about him because when I do, I just want to... I know, God, I know. My entire life I've daydreamed about killing Marcus. Once I even decided how I would do it with a knife, so I could feel the warmth leave him, so I could be close enough to watch the light leave his eyes. Making that decision frightened me as much as his violence ever did. My parents would want me to save him, though. Her eyes open and lift to the sky. They would say it's selfish to let someone die just because they wronged you. Forgive, forgive, forgive. This isn't about what they want, Triss. Yes, it is. She presses away from the wall. It's always about what they want. Because he belongs to them more than he belongs to me. And I want to make them proud of me. It's all I want. Her pale eyes are steady on mine. Determined. I have never had parents who set good examples, parents whose expectations were worth living up to, but she did. I can see them within her, the courage and the beauty they pressed into her like a handprint. I touch her cheek, sliding my fingers into her hair. I'll get him out. What? I'll get him out of his cell. Tomorrow, before we leave. I nod. I'll do it.
Really? Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure.
I...
She frowns up at me.
Thank you. You're... amazing.
Don't say that. You haven't found out about my ulterior motives yet. I grin. You see, I didn't bring you here to talk to you about Caleb, actually.
Oh?
I set my hands on her hips and push her gently back against the wall. She looks up at me, her eyes clear and eager. I lean in close enough to taste her breaths, but pull back when she leans in, teasing, She hooks her fingers in my belt loops and pulls me against her, so I have to catch myself on my forearms. She tries to kiss me, but I tilt my head to dodge her, kissing just under her ear, then along her jaw to her throat. Her skin is soft and tastes like salt, like a night run. "Do me a favor," she whispers into my ear, "and never have pure motives again." She puts her hands on me, touching all the places I am marked, down my back and over my sides. Her fingertips slip under the waistband of my jeans and hold me against her. I breathe against the side of her neck, unable to move. Finally, we kiss. And it is a relief. She sighs, and I feel a wicked smile creep across my face. I lift her up, letting the wall bear most of her weight, and her legs drape around my waist. She laughs into another kiss, and I feel strong, but so does she, her fingers stern around my arms. The night air slips into my lungs, and I feel like it is one of my first breaths. Chapter 10. Tobias. The broken buildings in the Dauntless Sector look like doorways to other worlds. Ahead of me, I see the pyre piercing the sky. The pulse in my fingertips marks the passing seconds. The air still feels rich in my lungs, though summer is drawing to a close. I used to run all the time and fight all the time because I cared about muscles. Now my feet have saved me too often, and I can't separate running and fighting from what they are. A way to escape danger. A way to stay alive. When I reach the building, I pace before the entrance to catch my breath. Above me, panes of glass reflect light in every direction. Somewhere up there is the chair I sat in while I was running the attack simulation, and a smear of Triss's father's blood on the wall. Somewhere up there, Triss's voice pierced the simulation I was under, and I felt her hand on my chest, drawing me back to reality. I open the door to the Fear landscape room, and flip open the small black box that was in my back pocket to see the syringes inside. This is the box I have always used, padded around the needles. It is a sign of something sick inside me, or something brave. I position the needle over my throat and close my eyes as I press down on the plunger. The black box clatters to the ground, but by the time I open my eyes, it has disappeared. I stand on the roof of the Hancock building, near the zip line where the Dauntless flirt with death. The clouds are black with rain, and the wind fills my mouth when I open it to breathe. To my right, the zip line snaps, the wire cord whipping back and shattering the windows below me. My vision tightens around the roof edge, trapping it in the center of a pinhole. I can hear my own exhales despite the whistling wind. I force myself to walk to the edge. The rain pounds against my shoulders and head, dragging me toward the ground. I tip my weight forward just a little and fall, my jaw clamped around my screams, muffled and suffocated by my own fear. After I land, I don't have a second to rest before the walls close in around me, the wood slamming into my spine, and then my head, and then my legs. Claustrophobia. I pull my arms into my chest, close my eyes, and try not to panic. I think of Eric in his fear landscape, willing his terror into submission with deep breathing and logic. And Triss, conjuring weapons out of thin air to attack her worst nightmares. But I am not Eric, and I am not Triss. What am I? What do I need to overcome my fears? I know the answer. Of course I do. I need to deny them the power to control me. I need to know that I am stronger than they are. I breathe in and slam my palms against the walls to my left and right. The box creaks and then breaks, the boards crashing to the concrete floor. I stand above them in the dark. Amar, my initiation instructor, taught us that our fear landscapes were always in flux, shifting with our moods and changing with the little whispers of our nightmares. Mine was always the same, until a few weeks ago. Until until I proved to myself that I could overpower my father, until I discovered someone I was terrified to lose. I don't know what I will see next. I wait for a long time without anything changing. The room is still dark, the floor still cold and hard, my heart still beating faster than normal. I look down to check my watch and discover that it's on the wrong hand. I usually wear mine on my left, not my right. And my watch band isn't gray. It's black. Then I notice bristly hairs on my fingers that weren't there before. The calluses on my knuckles are gone. I look down and I am wearing gray slacks and a gray shirt. I am thicker around the middle and thinner through the shoulders. I lift my eyes to a mirror that now stands in front of me. The face staring back at mine is Marcus's. He winks at me, and I feel the muscles around my eye contracting as he does, though I didn't tell them to. Without warning, our arms jerk toward the glass and reach into it, closing around the neck of my reflection. But then the mirror disappears, and our hands are around our own throat, dark patches creeping into the edge of our vision. We sink to the ground, and the grip is as tight as iron. I can't think of a way out of this one. By instinct, I scream. The sound vibrates against my hands. I picture those hands as mine really are, large with slender fingers and calloused knuckles from hours at the punching bag. I imagine my reflection as water running over Marcus's skin, replacing every piece of him with a piece of me. I remake myself in my own image. I am kneeling on the concrete, gasping for air. My hands tremble, and I run my fingers over my neck, my shoulders, my arms, just to make sure. I told Triss on the train to meet Evelyn a few weeks ago that Marcus was still in my fear landscape, but that he had changed. I spent a long time thinking about it. It crowded my thoughts every night before I slept, and clamored for attention every time I woke. I was still afraid of him, I knew, but in a different way. I was no longer a child, afraid of the threat my terrifying father posed to my safety. I was a man, afraid of the threat he posed to my character, to my future, to my identity. But even that fear, I know, does not compare to the one that comes next. Even though I know it's coming, I want to open a vein and draw the serum from my body rather than see it again. A pool of light appears on the concrete in front of me. A hand, the fingers bent into claws, reaches into the light, followed by another hand, and then a head, with stringy blonde hair. The woman coughs and drags herself into the circle of light, inch by inch. I try to move toward her, to help her, but I am frozen. The woman turns her face toward the light, and I see that she is Triss. Blood spills over her lips and curls around her chin. Her bloodshot eyes find mine, and she wheezes, "Help!" She coughs red onto the floor, and I throw myself toward her, somehow knowing that if I don't get to her soon, the light will leave her eyes. Hands wrap around my arms and shoulders and chest, forming a cage of flesh and bone, but I keep straining toward her. I claw at the hands holding me, but I only end up scratching myself. I shout her name and she coughs again, this time more blood. She screams for help and I scream for her. And I don't hear anything, I don't feel anything but my heartbeat, but my own terror. She drops to the ground, tensionless, and her eyes roll back into her head. It's too late. The darkness lifts. The lights return. Graffiti covers the walls of the fear landscape room. And across from me are the mirror windows to the observation room. And in the corners are the cameras that record each session, all where they are supposed to be. My neck and back are covered in sweat. I wipe my face with the hem of my shirt and walk to the opposite door, leaving my black box with its syringe and needle behind. I don't need to relive my fears anymore. All I need to do now is try to overcome them. I know from experience that confidence alone can get a person into a forbidden place, like the cells on the third floor of Erudite headquarters. Not here, though, apparently. A factionless man stops me with the end of his gun before I reach the door, and I am nervous, choking.
Where are you going?
I put my hand on his gun and push it away from my arm. Don't point that thing at me. I'm here on Evelyn's orders. I'm going to see a prisoner.
I didn't hear about any after-hours visits today.
I drop my voice low so he feels like he's hearing a secret. That's because she didn't want it on the record.
Chuck!
Someone calls out from the stairs above us. It's Therese. She makes a waving motion as she walks down.
Let him through, he's fine.
I nod to Therese and keep moving. The debris in the hallways has been swept clean, but the broken light bulbs haven't been replaced, so I walk through stretches of darkness, like patches of bruises on my way to the right cell. When I reach the north corridor, I don't go straight to the cell, but rather to the woman who stands at the end. She is middle-aged, with eyes that droop at the edges and a mouth held in a pucker. She looks like everything exhausts her, including me. Hi, I say. My name is Tobias Eaton. I'm here to collect a prisoner, on orders from Evelyn Johnson. Her expression doesn't change when she hears my name, so for a few seconds I'm sure I'll have to knock her unconscious to get what I want. She takes a piece of crumpled paper from her pocket and flattens it against her left palm. On it is a list of prisoners' names and their corresponding room numbers.
Name? She says.
Caleb Pryor, 308A.
You're Evelyn's son, right?
Yeah, I mean, yes. She doesn't seem like the kind of person who likes the word yeah. She leads me to a blank metal door with 308A on it. I wonder what it was used for when our city didn't require so many cells. She types in the code, and the door springs open.
I guess I'm supposed to pretend I don't see what you're about to do, she says.
She must think I'm here to kill him. I decide to let her. Yes, I say.
Do me a favor,
and put in a good word for me with Evelyn. I don't want so many night shifts.
The name's Drea.
You got it. She gathers the paper into her fist and shoves it back into her pocket as she walks away. I keep my hand on the door handle until she reaches her post again and turns to the side so she isn't facing me. It seems like she's done this a few times before. I wonder how many people have disappeared from these cells at Evelyn's command. I walk in. Caleb Pryor sits at a metal desk, bent over a book, his hair piled on one side of his head.
What do you want?
He says. I hate to break this to you. I pause. I decided a few hours ago how I wanted to handle this. I want to teach Caleb a lesson, and it will involve a few lies.
You know, actually, I kind of don't hate it. Your execution's been moved up a few weeks, to tonight.
That gets his attention. He twists in his chair and stares at me, his eyes wild and wide, like prey faced with a predator.
Is that a joke?
I'm really bad at telling jokes.
No,
he shakes his head.
No, I have a few weeks. It's not tonight. No.
If you shut up, I'll give you an hour to adjust to this new information. If you don't shut up, I'll knock you out and shoot you in the alley outside before you wake up. Make your choice now.
Seeing an erudite process something is like watching the inside of a watch. The gears all turning, shifting, adjusting, working together to form a particular function, which in this case is to make sense of his imminent demise. Caleb's eyes shift to the open door behind me, and he seizes the chair, turning and swinging it into my body. The legs hit me hard, which slows me down just enough to let him slip by. I follow him into the hallway, my arms burning from where the chair hit me. I am faster than he is. I slam into his back and he hits the floor face first without bracing himself. With my knee against his back, I pull his wrists together and squeeze them into a plastic loop. He groans, and when I pull him to his feet, his nose is bright with blood. Drea's eyes touch mine for just a moment, then move away. I drag him down the hallway, not the way I came, but another way, toward an emergency exit. We walk down a flight of narrow stairs where the echo of our footsteps layers over itself, dissonant and hollow. Once I'm at the bottom, I knock on the exit door. Zeke opens it, a stupid grin on his face. No trouble with the guard? No. I figured Drea would be easy to get by. She doesn't care about anything. It sounded like she'd looked the other way before. That doesn't surprise me. Is this Pryor? In the flesh. Why is he bleeding? Because he's an idiot. Zeke offers me a black jacket with a factionless symbol stitched into the collar. I didn't know that idiocy caused people to just start spontaneously bleeding from the nose. I wrap the jacket around Caleb's shoulders and fasten one of the buttons over his chest. He avoids my eyes. I think it's a new phenomenon, I say. The alley's clear? Made sure of it. Zeke holds out his gun, handle first. Careful, it's loaded. Now, it would be great if you would hit me so I'm more convincing when I tell the factionless you stole it from me. You want me to hit you? Oh, like you've never wanted to. Just do it for. I do like to hit people. I like the explosion of power and energy, and the feeling that I am untouchable because I can hurt people. But I hate that part of myself because it is the part of me that is the most broken. Zeke braces himself and I curl my hand into a fist. Do it fast, you pansy cake, he says. I decide to aim for the jaw, which is too strong to break, but will still show a good bruise. I swing, hitting him right where I mean to. Zeke groans, clutching his face with both hands. Pain shoots up my arm and I shake my hand out. Great. Zeke spits at the side of the building. Well, I guess that's it. Guess so. I probably won't be seeing you again, will I? I mean, I know the others might come back, but you... He trails off, but picks up the thought again a moment later. Just seems like you'll be happy to leave it behind, that's all. Yeah, you're probably right. Now look at my shoes. You sure you won't come? Can't. Shauna can't wheel around where you guys are going, and it's not like I'm gonna leave her, you know? He touches his jaw, lightly, testing the skin. Make sure Yuri doesn't drink too much, okay? Yeah, I say. No, I mean it, he says, and his voice dips down the way it always does when he's being serious for once. Promise you'll look out for him. It's always been clear to me since I met them that Zeke and Uriah were closer than most brothers. They lost their father when they were young, and I suspect Zeke began to walk the line between parent and sibling after that. I can't imagine what it feels like for Zeke to watch him leave the city now, especially as broken by grief as Uriah is by Marlene's death. I promise, I say. I know I should leave, but I have to stay in this moment for a little while, feeling its significance. Zeke was one of the first friends I made in Dauntless after I survived initiation. Then he worked in the control room with me, watching the cameras and writing stupid programs that spelled out words on the screen, or played guessing games with numbers. He never asked me for my real name, or why a first-ranked initiate ended up in security and instruction instead of leadership. He demanded nothing from me. Let's just hug already, he says. Keeping one hand firm on Caleb's arm, I wrap my free arm around Zeke, and he does the same. When we break apart, I pull Caleb down the alley, and can't resist calling back, I'll miss you. You too, sweetie. He grins, and his teeth are white in the twilight. They are the last thing I see of him before I have to turn and set out at a trot for the train. You're going somewhere, says Caleb between breaths. You and some others. Yeah. Is my sister going? The question awakes inside me an animal rage that won't be satisfied by sharp words or insults. It will only be satisfied by smacking his ear hard with the flat of my hand. He winces and hunches his shoulders, preparing for a second strike. I wonder if that's what I looked like when my father did it to me, She is not your sister, I say. You betrayed her. You tortured her. You took away the only family she had left. And because... what? Because you wanted to keep Janine's secrets? Wanted to stay in the city, safe and sound? You are a coward.
I am not a coward, Caleb says. I knew if...
Let's go back to the arrangement where you keep your mouth closed.
Fine, he says.
Where are you taking me anyway?
You can kill me just as well here, can't you?
I pause. A shape moves along the sidewalk behind us, slippery in my periphery. I twist and hold up my gun, but the shape disappears into the yawn of an alley. I keep walking, pulling Caleb with me, listening for footsteps behind me. We scatter broken glass with our shoes. I watch the dark buildings and the street signs dangling from their hinges like late clinging leaves in autumn. Then I reach the station where we'll catch the train and lead Caleb up a flight of metal steps to the platform. I see the train coming from a long way off, making its last journey through the city. Once the trains were a force of nature to me, something that continued along their paths regardless of what we did inside the city limits, something pulsing and alive and powerful. Now I have met the men and women who operate them, and some of that mystery is gone. But what they mean to me will never be gone. My first act as a Dauntless was to jump on one, and every day afterwards they were the source of my freedom. They gave me the power to move within this world when I had once felt so trapped in the abnegation sector, in the house that was a prison to me. When it comes closer, I cut the tie on Caleb's wrists with a pocket knife and keep a firm hold on his arm. You know how to do this, right? I say. Get in the last car. He unbuttons the jacket and drops it on the ground. Yeah. Starting at one end of the platform, we run together along the worn boards, keeping pace with the open door. He doesn't reach for the handle, so I push him toward it. He stumbles, then grabs it and pulls himself into the last car. I am running out of space. The platform is ending. I seize the handle and swing myself in, my muscles absorbing the pull forward. Triss stands inside the car, wearing a small, crooked smile. Her black jacket is zipped up to her throat, framing her face in darkness. She grabs my collar and pulls me in for a kiss. As she pulls away, she says, "I always loved watching you do that." I grin.
"Is this what you had planned?" Caleb demands from behind me. "For her to be here when you kill me? That's...
kill him?" Triss asks me, not looking at her brother. "Yeah. I let him think he was being taken to his execution," I say, loud enough that he can hear. "You know, sort of like he did to you in Erudite headquarters."
It isn't true?
His face lit by the moon is slack with shock. I notice that his shirt's buttons are in the wrong buttonholes. "No," I say. "I just saved your life, actually." He starts to say something and I interrupt him. "Might not want to thank me just yet. We're taking you with us. Outside the fence." Outside the fence. The place he once tried so hard to avoid that he turned on his own sister. It seems a more fitting punishment than death anyway. Death is so quick, so certain. Where we're going now, nothing is certain. He looks frightened, but not as frightened as I thought he would be. I feel like I understand, then, the way he ranks things in his mind. His life, first. His comfort in a world of his own making, second. And somewhere after that, the lives of the people he is supposed to love. He is the sort of despicable person who has no understanding of how despicable he is. And my badgering him with insults won't change that. Nothing will. Rather than angry, I just feel heavy. Useless. I don't want to think about him anymore. I take Triss's hand and lead her to the other side of the car so we can watch the city disappear behind us. We stand side by side in the open doorway, each of us holding one of the handles. The buildings create a dark, jagged pattern on the sky. "We were followed," I say. "We'll be careful," she answers. "Where are the others?"
"In the first few cars," she says.
I thought we should be alone. Or as alone as we can get. She smiles at me. These are our last moments in the city. Of course we should spend them alone.
I'm really gonna miss this place, she says.
Really, I say. My thoughts are more like good riddance.
There's nothing you'll miss? No good memories?
She elbows me. Fine, I smile. There are a few.
Any that don't involve me?
She says. That sounds self-centered, you know what I mean.
Sure, I guess, I say, shrugging. I mean, I got to have a different life in Dauntless. A different name. I got to be four thanks to my initiation instructor. He gave me the name.
Really?
She tilts her head.
Why haven't I met him?
Because he's dead. He was divergent. I shrug again, but I don't feel casual about it. Amar was the first person who noticed that I was divergent, and he helped me to hide it. But he couldn't hide his own divergence, and that killed him. She touches my arm lightly, but doesn't say anything. I shift, uncomfortable. See, I say. Too many bad memories here. I'm ready to leave. I feel empty. Not because of sadness, but because of relief. All the tension flowing out of me. Evelyn is in that city. And Marcus. And all the grief and nightmares and bad memories. And the factions that kept me trapped inside one version of myself. I squeeze Triss's hand. Look, I say, pointing at a distant cluster of buildings. There's the abnegation sector. She smiles, but her eyes are glassy, like a dormant part of her is fighting its way out and spilling over. The train hisses over the rails. A tear drops down Triss's cheek, and the city disappears into the darkness.
Chapter 11. Triss. The train slows down when we get closer to the fence, a signal from the driver that we should get off soon. Tobias and I sit in the doorway of the car as it moves lazily over the tracks. He puts his arm around me and touches his nose to my hair, taking a breath. I look at him, at the collarbone peeking out from the neck of his t-shirt, at the faint curl of his lip, and I feel something heating up inside me.
What are you thinking about? He says into my ear softly.
I jerk to attention. I look at him all the time, but not always like that. I feel like he just caught me doing something embarrassing. Nothing. Why?
No reason.
He pulls me closer to his side, and I rest my head on his shoulder, taking deep breaths of the cool air. It still smells like summer, like grass baking in the heat of the sun. It looks like we're getting close to the fence, I say. I can tell because the buildings are disappearing, leaving just fields, dotted with the rhythmic glow of lightning bugs. Behind me, Caleb sits near the other door, hugging his knees. His eyes find mine at just the wrong moment, and I want to scream into the darkest part of him so he can finally hear me, finally understand what he did to me. But instead, I just hold his stare. Until he can't take it anymore, and he looks away. I stand, using the handle to steady me, and Tobias and Caleb do the same. At first, Caleb tries to stand behind us, but Tobias pushes him forward, right up to the edge of the car.
You first. On my mark, he says. And go.
He gives Caleb a push, just enough to get him off the car floor. And my brother disappears. Tobias goes next, leaving me alone in the train car. It's stupid to miss a thing when there are so many people to miss instead. But I miss this train already, and all the others that carried me through the city, my city, after I was brave enough to ride them. I brush my fingers over the car wall, just once, and then jump. The train is moving so slowly that I overcompensate with my landing. Too used to running off the momentum, and I fall. The dry grass scrapes my palms, and I push myself to my feet, searching the darkness for Tobias and Caleb.
Before I find them, I hear Christina.
Triss!
She and Uriah come toward me. He is holding a flashlight, and he looks far more alert than he did this afternoon, which is a good sign. Behind them are more lights, more voices.
Did your brother make it? Uriah says.
Yeah. Finally, I see Tobias, his hand gripping Caleb's arm, coming toward us.
Not sure why an erudite like you can't get it through his head, Tobias is saying, but you aren't going to be able to outrun me.
He's right, says Uriah. Force fast. Not as fast as me, but definitely faster than a nose like you. Christina laughs.
A what?
Nose. Uriah touches the side of his nose. It's a play on words. Nose, with a K. Knowledge, erudite. Get it? It's like stiff.
The Dauntless have the weirdest slang. Pansy cake, nose. Is there a term for the candor?
Of course. Uriah grins.
Jerks.
Christina shoves Uriah. Hard, making him drop the flashlight. Tobias, laughing, leads us to the rest of the group, standing a few feet away. Tori waves her flashlight in the air to get everyone's attention, then says,
All right, Johanna and the trucks will be about a 10-minute walk from here, so let's get going. And if I hear a word from anyone, I will beat you senseless. We're not out yet.
We move closer together like sections of a tightened shoelace. Tori walks a few feet in front of us. And from the back, in the dark, she reminds me of Evelyn. Her limbs lean and wiry, her shoulders back, so sure of herself it's almost frightening. By the light of the flashlight, I can just make out the tattoo of a hawk on the back of her neck. The first thing I spoke to her about when she administered my aptitude test. She told me it was a symbol of a fear she had overcome, a fear of the dark. I wonder if that fear still creeps up on her now. Though she worked so hard to face it, I wonder if fears ever really go away, or if they just lose their power over us. She moves farther away from us by the minute, her pace more like a jog than a walk. She is eager to leave, to escape this place where her brother was murdered, and she rose to prominence only to be thwarted by a factionless woman who wasn't supposed to be alive. She is so far ahead that when the shots go off, I only see her flashlight fall, not her body.
Split up!
Tobias's voice roars over the sound of our cries, our chaos.
Run!
I search in the dark for his hand, but I don't find it. I grab the gun Uriah gave me before we left and hold it out for my body, ignoring the way my throat tightens at the feel of it. I can't run into the night. I need light. I sprint in the direction of Tori's body, of her fallen flashlight. I hear but do not hear the gunshots, and the shouting, and the running footsteps. I hear but do not hear my heartbeat. I crouch next to the shaft of light she dropped and pick up the flashlight, intending to just grab it and keep running. But in its glow, I see her face. It shines with sweat, and her eyes roll beneath her eyelids. Like she is searching for something, but is too tired to find it. One of the bullets found her stomach, and the other found her chest. There is no way she will recover from this. I may be angry with her for fighting me in Janine's laboratory, but she's still Tori, the woman who guarded the secret of my divergence. My throat tightens as I remember following her into the aptitude test room, my eyes on her hawk tattoo. Her eyes shift in my direction and focus on me, her eyebrows furrow, but she doesn't speak. I shift the flashlight into the crook of my thumb and reach for her hand to squeeze her sweaty fingers. I hear someone approaching, and I aim flashlight and gun in the same direction. The beam hits a woman wearing a factionless armband with a gun pointed at my head. I fire, clenching my teeth so hard they squeak. The bullet hits the woman in the stomach, and she screams, firing blindly into the night. I look back down at Tori, and her eyes are closed, her body still. Pointing my flashlight at the ground, I sprint away from her and from the woman I just shot. My legs ache,
and my lungs burn. I don't know where I'm going, if I'm running into danger or away from it, but I keep running as long as I can. Finally, I see a light in the distance. At first, I think it's another flashlight, but as I draw closer, I realize it is larger and steadier than a flashlight. It's a headlight. I hear an engine and crouch in the tall grass to hide, switching my flashlight off and keeping my gun ready. The truck slows, and I hear a voice. Tori? It sounds like Christina. The truck is red and rusted, an Amity vehicle. I straighten, pointing the light at myself so she'll see me. The truck stops a few feet ahead of me, and Christina leaps out of the passenger seat, throwing her arms around me. I replay it in my mind to make it real. Tori's body falling, the factionless woman's hands covering her stomach. It doesn't work. It doesn't feel real. Thank God, Christina says. Get in. We're going to find Tori. Tori's dead, I say plainly, and the word, dead, makes it real for me. I wipe tears from my cheeks with the heels of my hands and struggle to control my shuddering breaths. I shot the woman who killed her. What? Johanna sounds frantic. She leans over from the driver's seat. What did you say? Tori's gone, I say. I saw it happen. Johanna's expression is shrouded by her hair. She presses her next breath out. Well, let's find the others then. I get into the truck. The engine roars as Johanna presses the gas pedal, and we bump over the grass in search of the others. Did you see any of them? I say. A few. Kara, Uriah. Johanna shakes her head. No one else. I wrap my hand around the door handle and squeeze. If I had tried harder to find Tobias, if I hadn't stopped for Tori. What if Tobias didn't make it? I'm sure they're all right, Johanna says. That boy of yours knows how to take care of himself. I nod, without conviction. Tobias can take care of himself, but in an attack, surviving is an accident. It doesn't take skill to stand in a place where no bullets find you, or to fire into the dark and hit a man you didn't see. It is all luck, or providence, depending on what you believe. And I don't know, have never known, exactly what I believe. He's all right. He's all right. He's all right. Tobias is all right. My hands tremble, and Christina squeezes my knee. Johanna steers us toward the rendezvous point, where she saw Uriah and Kara. I watch the speedometer needle climb, then hold steady at 75. We jostle one another in the cab, thrown this way and that way by the uneven ground. There! Christina points. There is a cluster of lights ahead of us, some just pinpricks, like flashlights, and others round, like headlights. We pull up close, and I see him. Tobias sits on the hood of the other truck, his arms soaked with blood. Kara stands in front of him with a first aid kit. Caleb and Peter sit on the grass a few feet away. Before Johanna has stopped the truck completely, I open the door and get out, running toward him. Tobias stands up, ignoring Kara's orders to stay put, and we collide, his uninjured arm wrapping around my back and lifting me off my feet. His back is wet with sweat, and when he kisses me, he tastes like salt. All the knots of tension inside me come apart at once. I feel, just for a moment, like I am remade, like I am brand new. He's all right. We're out of the city. He's all right.
Chapter 12. Tobias. My arm throbs like a second heartbeat from the bullet graze. Triss's knuckles brush mine as she lifts her hand to point at something on our right. A series of long, low buildings lit by blue emergency lamps. What are those? Triss says. The other greenhouses, Johanna says.
They don't require much manpower, but we grow and raise things in large quantities there. Animals, raw material for fabric, wheat, and so on. Their panes glow in the starlight, obscuring the treasures I imagine to be inside them. Small plants with berries dangling from their branches. Rows of potato plants buried in the earth. You don't show them to visitors, I say. We never saw them. Amity keeps a number of secrets, Johanna says, and she sounds proud. The road ahead of us is long and straight, marked with cracks and swollen patches. Alongside it are gnarled trees, broken lampposts, old power lines. Every so often there is an isolated square of sidewalk with weeds forcing their way through the concrete, or a pile of rotting wood, a collapsed dwelling. The more time I spend thinking about this landscape that every dauntless patrol was told was normal, the more I see an old city rising up around me, the buildings lower than the ones we left behind, but just as numerous. An old city that was transformed into empty land for the Amity to farm. In other words, an old city that was razed, burned to cinders and crushed into the ground, even the roads disappearing, the earth left to run wild over the wreckage. I put my hand out the window and the wind wraps around my fingers like locks of hair. When I was very young, my mother pretended she could shape things from the wind, and she would give them to me to use, like hammers and nails, or swords, or roller skates. It was a game we played in the evenings on the front lawn before Marcus got home. It took away our dread. In the bed of the truck behind us are Caleb, Christina, and Uriah. Christina and Uriah sit close enough for their shoulders to touch, but they are looking in opposite directions, more like strangers than friends. Just behind us is another truck, driven by Robert, which carries Kara and Peter. Tori was supposed to be with them. The thought makes me feel hollow, empty. She administered my aptitude test. She made me think for the first time that I could leave abnegation, that I had to. I feel like I owe her something, and she died before I could give it to her. This is it, Johanna says. The outer limit of the Dauntless Patrols. No fence or wall marks the divide between the Amity compound and the outer world. But I remember monitoring the Dauntless Patrols from the control room, making sure they didn't go farther than the limit, which is marked by a series of signs with X's on them. The patrols were structured so that the trucks would run out of gas if they went too far. A delicate system of checks and balances that preserved our safety and theirs. And now I realized the secret the abnegation kept. Have they ever gone past the limit? Says Triss. A few times, says Johanna. It was our responsibility to deal with that situation when it came up. Triss gives her a look, and she shrugs. Every faction has a serum, Johanna says. The Dauntless serum gives hallucinated realities. Candor's gives the truth. Amity's gives peace. Erudite's gives death. At this, Triss visibly shudders, but Johanna continues as if it didn't happen. And abnegations resets memory. Resets memory? Like Amanda Ritter's memory, I say. She said there are many things I am happy to forget, remember? Yes, exactly, says Johanna. The Amity are charged with administering the abnegation serum to anyone who goes out past the limit. Just enough to make them forget the experience. I'm sure some of them have slipped past us, but not many. We are silent, then. I turn the information over and over in my mind. There is something deeply wrong with taking a person's memories, even though I know it was necessary to keep our city safe for as long as it needed to be. I feel it in the pit of my stomach. Take a person's memories, and you change who they are. Swelling inside me is the feeling that I am about to jump out of my own skin, because the farther we get outside the outer limit of the Dauntless Patrols, the closer we get to seeing what lies outside the only world I've ever known. I am terrified and thrilled and confused and 100 different things at once. I see something up ahead of us in the light of the early morning and grab Triss's hand. Look, I say.
Chapter 13. Triss. The world beyond ours is full of roads and dark buildings and collapsing power lines. There is no life in it, as far as I can see. No movement, no sound but the wind and my own footsteps. It's like the landscape is an interrupted sentence, one side dangling in the air, unfinished, and the other, a completely different subject. On our side of that sentence is empty land, grass and stretches of road. On the other side are two concrete walls with half a dozen sets of train tracks between them. Up ahead, there is a concrete bridge built across the walls, and framing the tracks are buildings, wood and brick and glass, their windows dark, trees growing around them, so wild their branches have grown together. A sign on the right says 90. "What do we do now?" Uriah asks. "We follow the tracks," I say, but quietly, so only I hear it. We get out of the trucks at the divide between our world and theirs, whoever they are. Robert and Johanna say a brief goodbye, turn the trucks around, and drive back into the city. I watch them go. I can't imagine coming this far and then turning back. But I guess there are things they have to do in the city. Johanna still has an Allegiant rebellion to organize. The rest of us, me, Tobias, Caleb, Peter, Christina, Uriah, and Kara, set out with our meager possessions along the railroad tracks. The tracks are not like the ones in the city. They are polished and sleek, and instead of boards running perpendicular to their path, there are sheets of textured metal. Up ahead, I see one of the trains that runs along them, abandoned near the wall. It is metal-plated on the top and front, like a mirror, with tinted windows all along the side. When we draw closer, I see rows of benches inside it, with maroon cushions on them. People must not jump on and off these trains. Tobias walks behind me, on one of the rails, his arms held out from his sides to maintain his balance. The others are spread out over the tracks, Peter and Caleb near one wall, Kara near the other. No one talks much, except to point out something new, a sign or a building, or a hint of what this world was like, when there were people in it. The concrete walls alone hold my attention. They are covered with strange pictures of people, with skin so smooth they hardly look like people anymore, or colorful bottles with shampoo or conditioner, or vitamins, or unfamiliar substances inside them. Words I don't understand. Vodka, and Coca-Cola, and energy drink. The colors and shapes and words and pictures are so garish, so abundant, that they are mesmerizing. "Tris." Tobias puts his hand on my shoulder, and I stop. He tilts his head and says, "Do you hear that?" I hear footsteps, and the quiet voices of our companions. I hear my own breaths, and his. But running beneath them is a quiet rumble, inconsistent in its intensity. It sounds like an engine. "Everyone stop!" I shout. To my surprise, everyone does, even Peter, and we gather together in the center of the tracks. I see Peter draw his gun and hold it up, and I do the same, both hands joined together to steady it, remembering the ease with which I used to lift it. That ease is gone now. Something appears around the bend up ahead. A black truck, but larger than any truck I've ever seen. Large enough to hold more than a dozen people in its covered bed. I shudder. The truck bumps over the tracks and comes to a stop 20 feet away from us. I can see the man driving it. He has dark skin and long hair that is in a knot at the back of his head. "God," Tobias says, and his hands tighten around his own gun. A woman gets out of the front seat. She looks to be around Johanna's age, her skin patterned with dense freckles, and her hair so dark it's almost black. She hops to the ground and puts up both hands, so we can see that she isn't armed. "Hello," she says, and smiles nervously.
My name is Zoe. This is Amar.
She jerks her head to the side to indicate the driver, who has gotten out of the truck, too.
Amar is dead, Tobias says.
No, I'm not.
Come on, Four, Amar says.
Tobias's face is tight with fear. I don't blame him. It's not every day you see someone you care about come back from the dead.
The faces of all the people I've lost flash into my mind. Lynn, Marlene, Will, Al, my father, my mother. What if they're still alive, like Amar? What if the curtain that separates us is not death, but a chain-link fence and some land? I can't stop myself from hoping, foolish as it is.
We work for the same organization that founded your city, Zoe says as she glares at Amar. The same organization Edith Pryor came from. And,
she reaches into her pocket and takes out a partially crumpled photograph. She holds it out, and then her eyes find mine in the crowd of people and guns.
I think you should look at this, Triss, she says. I'll step forward and leave it on the ground, then back up, all right?
She knows my name. My throat tightens with fear. How does she know my name? And not just my name, my nickname, the name I chose when I joined Dauntless.
All right, I say, but my voice is hoarse, so the words barely escape.
Zoe steps forward, sets the photograph down on the train tracks, then moves back to her original position. I leave the safety of our numbers and crouch near the photograph, watching her the whole time. Then I back up, photograph in hand. It shows a row of people in front of a chain-link fence, their arms slung around one another's shoulders and backs. I see a child version of Zoe, recognizable by her freckles, and a few people I don't recognize. I am about to ask her what the point of me looking at this picture is, when I recognize the young woman with dull blonde hair, tied back, and a wide smile. My mother. What is my mother doing next to these people?
Something. Grief. Pain. Longing squeezes my chest.
There is a lot to explain, Zoe says, but this isn't really the best place to do it. We'd like to take you to our headquarters. It's a short drive from here.
Still holding up his gun, Tobias touches my wrist with his free hand, guiding the photograph closer to his face.
That's your mother? He asks me.
It's Mom? Caleb says. He pushes past Tobias to see the picture over my shoulder.
Yes, I say to both of them.
Think we should trust them? Tobias says to me in a low voice.
Zoe doesn't look like a liar, and she doesn't sound like one either. And if she knows who I am, and knew how to find us here, it's probably because she has some form of access to the city, which means she is probably telling the truth about being with the group that Edith Pryor came from. And then there's Amar, who is watching every movement Tobias makes.
We came out here because we wanted to find these people, I say. We have to trust someone, don't we?
Or else we're just walking around in a wasteland, possibly starving to death.
Tobias releases my wrist and lowers his gun. I do the same. The others follow suit slowly, with Christina putting hers down last.
Wherever we go, we have to be free to leave at any time, Christina says. Okay?
Zoe places her hand on her chest, right over her heart.
You have my word.
I hope, for all our sakes, that her word is worth having.
Chapter 14. Tobias. I stand on the edge of the truck bed, holding the structure that supports the cloth cover. I want this new reality to be a simulation that I could manipulate if only I could make sense of it. But it's not, and I can't make sense of it. Amar is alive. Adapt was one of his favorite commands during my initiation.
Sometimes he yelled it so often that I would dream it. It woke me like an alarm clock, requiring more of me than I could provide. Adapt. Adapt faster, adapt better, adapt to things that no man should have to. Like this, leaving a wholly formed world and discovering another one. Or this, discovering that your dead friend is actually alive and driving the truck you're riding in. Triss sits behind me on the bench that wraps around the truck bed, the creased photo in her hands. Her fingers hover over her mother's face, almost touching it, but not quite. Christina sits on one side of her, and Caleb is on the other. She must be letting him stay just to see the photograph. Her entire body recoils from him, pressing into Christina's side. "That's your mom?" Christina says. Triss and Caleb both nod. "She's so young there." "Pretty, too," Christina adds. "Yes, she is. Was, I mean." I expect Triss to sound sad as she replies, like she's aching at the memory of her mother's fading beauty. Instead, her voice is nervous, her lips pursed in anticipation. I hope that she isn't brewing false hope. "Let me see it," Caleb says, stretching his hand out to his sister. Silently, and without really looking at him, she passes him the photograph. I turn back to the world we are driving away from, the end of the train tracks, the huge expanses of field, and in the distance, the hub, barely visible in the haze that covers the city's skyline. It's a strange feeling seeing it from this place, like I can still touch it if I stretch my hand far enough, though I have traveled so far away from it. Peter moves toward the edge of the truck bed next to me, holding the canvas to steady himself. The train tracks curve away from us now, and I can't see the fields anymore. The walls on either side of us gradually disappear as the land flattens out, and I see buildings everywhere. Some small, like the abnegation houses, and some wide, like city buildings turned on their sides. Trees, overgrown and huge, grow beyond the cement fixtures intended to keep them enclosed, their roots sprawling over the pavement. Perched on the edge of one rooftop is a row of blackbirds like the ones tattooed on Triss's collarbone. As the truck passes, they squawk and scatter into the air. This is a wild world. Just like that, it's too much for me to bear, and I have to back up and sit on one of the benches. I cradle my head in my hands, keeping my eyes shut so I can't take in any new information. I feel Triss's strong arm across my back, pulling me sideways into her narrow frame. My hands are numb. "Just focus on what's right here, right now," Kara says from across the truck. "Like how the truck is moving. It'll help." I try. I think about how hard the bench is beneath me, and how the truck always vibrates, even on flat ground, buzzing in my bones. I detect its tiny movements, left and right, forward and back, and absorb each bounce as it rolls over the rails. I focus until everything goes dark around us, and I don't feel the passage of time or the panic of discovery. I feel only our movement over the earth.
"You should probably look around now," Triss says, and she sounds weak.
Christina and Uriah stand where I stood, peering around the edge of the canvas wall. I look over their shoulders to see what we're driving toward. There is a tall fence stretching wide across the landscape, which looks empty compared to the densely packed buildings I saw before I sat down. The fence has vertical black bars with pointed ends that bend outward, as if to skewer anyone who might try to climb over it. A few feet past it is another fence, this one chain link like the one around the city, with barbed wire looped over the top. I hear a loud buzz coming from the second fence, an electric charge. People walk the space between them carrying guns that look a little like our paintball guns, but far more lethal, powerful pieces of machinery. A sign on the first fence reads, "Bureau of Genetic Welfare." I hear Amar's voice speaking to the armed guards, but I don't know what he's saying. A gate in the first fence opens to admit us, and then a gate in the second. Beyond the two fences is order. As far as I can see, there are low buildings separated by trimmed grass and fledgling trees,
The roads that connect them are well-maintained and well-marked, with arrows pointing to various destinations. Greenhouses, straight ahead. Security outpost, left. Officers' residences, right. Compound main, straight ahead. I get up and lean around the truck to see the compound, half my body hanging over the road. The Bureau of Genetic Welfare isn't tall, but it's still huge, wider than I can see. A mammoth of glass and steel and concrete. Behind the compound are a few tall towers with bulges at the top. I don't know why, but I think of the control room when I see them and wonder if that's what they are. Aside from the guards between the fences, there are few people outside. Those who are stop to watch us, but we drive away so quickly I don't see their expressions. The truck stops before a set of double doors, and Peter is the first to jump down. The rest of us spill out on the pavement behind him, and we are shoulder to shoulder, standing so close I can hear how fast everyone is breathing. In the city, we were divided by faction, by age, by history. But here all those divisions fall away. We are all we have.
Here we go,
mutters Triss, as Zoe and Amar approach. Here we go, I say to myself.
Welcome to the compound, says Zoe. This building used to be O'Hare Airport, one of the busiest airports in the country. Now it's the headquarters of the Bureau of Genetic Welfare, or just the Bureau, as we call it around here. It's an agency of the United States government. I feel my face going slack. I know all the words she's saying, except I'm not sure what an airport or United States is, but they don't make sense to me altogether. I'm not the only one who looks confused. Peter raises both eyebrows as if asking a question. Sorry, she says. I keep forgetting how little you all know. I believe it's your fault if we don't know anything, not ours, Peter points out. I should rephrase. Zoe smiles gently. I keep forgetting how little information we provided you with. An airport is a hub for air travel, and... Air travel? Says Christina, incredulous.
One of the technological developments that wasn't necessary for us to know about when we were inside the city was air travel, says Amar. It's safe, fast, and amazing.
Wow, says Triss.
She looks excited. I, however, think of speeding through the air high above the compound and feel like I might throw up.
Anyway, when the experiments were first developed, the airport was converted into this compound so that we could monitor the experiments from a distance, Zoe says. I'm going to walk you to the control room to meet David, the leader of the Bureau. You will see a lot of things you don't understand, but it may be best to get some preliminary explanations before you start asking me about them. So, take note of the things you want to learn more about, and feel free to ask me or Amar later.
She starts toward the entrance, and the doors part for her, pulled open by two armed guards who smile in greeting as she passes them. The contrast between the friendly greeting and the weapons propped against their shoulders is almost humorous. The guns are huge, and I wonder how they feel to shoot, if you can feel the deadly power in them just by curling your finger around the trigger. Cool air rushes over my face as I walk into the compound. Windows arch high above my head, letting in pale light. But that is the most appealing part about the place. The tile floor is dull with dirt and age, and the walls are gray and blank. Ahead of us is a sea of people and machinery, with a sign over it that says, Security Checkpoint. I don't understand why they need so much security.